Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for July 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron, of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This month's podcast focuses on the interaction of the private interest of patent owners and the public interest of freedom of medical research, treatment, and diagnosis. Our bodies contain DNA. DNA is made up of genes. Two of these genes, the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, are understood to help suppress the growth of cancer cells. When these genes are mutated, they don't perform that function properly, and the person with a mutated gene has a 36 to 85% chance of getting breast cancer and a 16 to 60% chance of getting ovarian cancer. The BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes were first isolated by a group of scientists affiliated with Myriad Genetics, the University of Utah Research Foundation, the American government, the University of Pennsylvania, Endo-Recherche of Quebec, Canada, and the Hospital for Sick Children Research and Development Limited Partnership in Toronto, Canada. They obtained patents on the isolated genes, as well as on methods of diagnosing cancer using the genes. Myriad Genetics is exclusively licensed to perform the tests using the patented genes. On May 12, 2009, the American Civil Liberties Union, on behalf of a group of interested parties including medical associations and patients, filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York to invalidate several of the claims of seven of the patents exclusively licensed to Myriad. The basis of the ACLU's suit is that the claims claim products of nature or abstract ideas and are unconstitutional under the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. My first guest is Chris Hansen, in-house counsel of the ACLU and the lawyer in charge of the Myriad case. I spoke with Chris by phone from his office in New York City. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Why is the ACLU acting on behalf of these people now? Why the attack on the Myriad patents now?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. The primary one, I suppose, is that it took us a while to understand both the science and the law in this area. This is not an area that has traditionally been handled by the ACLU, and it took us a little bit of time to get up to speed on it. But what I've said to people, and I think is true, is we came to this in a very common sense way. We have a science advisor at the ACLU, and she came to me and said, "Do you know that genes are patented?" And I said, "Well, that can't be true." And we began investigating and discovered it was true. And almost anybody you talk to when you say, "Do you know that human genes are patented or privately owned by companies?" says, "Well, that just can't be true." And in our view, it shouldn't be true. And that's why we brought this lawsuit.
In reading the complaint, you seem to be attacking the patents on two different bases. One, a very broad one based on constitutional and First Amendment rights, and the other attacks on whether it's patentable subject matter or not. So I'd like to deal with each of those separately. You plead that it is contrary to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the U.S. Constitution. That's the one that says that the federal government is allowed to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. On what basis are your clients submitting that these patents are contrary to this part of the U.S. Constitution?
Well, the part you just read says that patents are granted for purposes of advancing the arts, advancing science. If, in fact, the effect of these patents is to retard science, to make science more difficult, then it seems to us that it doesn't fulfill the requirement that the Constitution sets up.
You've also pleaded that they're contrary to the U.S. First Amendment rights. That's about freedom of speech and so forth. And what is your argument on that basis?
In many respects, the effect of these patents is much broader than the effects of patents on machines or objects. The effect of these patents really is to patent speech or knowledge in the area of the BRCA1 and BRCA2, the breast cancer genes. And the government ought not to be giving exclusive rights over areas of knowledge over or over forms of speech to a private company.
In the complaint, you're attacking the patent on the particular basis that there are claims on natural human genes, with natural mutations, any method of looking for mutations in those genes, and the ability to compare those genes with a standard to determine whether or not there's an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. And with respect to pleading that the genes themselves aren't new, your pleading seems to say nature made them, therefore they're not new.
Well, that's exactly right. There, it has long been a principle of patent law in the United States and, for that matter, worldwide, that you can't patent things that nature made, that patents are for things that people made. So that, for example, you can't patent basic elements like gold or oxygen. You can't patent basic laws of nature like gravity or E equals mc squared. Even if you're the person who figured it out, even if you're Einstein and you figured out E equals mc squared, you can't patent it because it's part of the basic knowledge of mankind, and it's also something created more by nature than by human beings. And that's what genes are. Genes are created by nature. No scientist created the BRCA1 gene. No scientist built the BRCA1 gene. They simply found it in nature. It's no different than finding gold in a mountain.
In paragraph 50 of your complaint, you point out that the U.S. Patent Office has a practice that says you can patent naturally occurring genes if they're isolated from their natural state and purified. I take it not only are you going after the patents, you're also going after the U.S. Patent Office in this case. What is the argument with respect to that policy?
Well, if the patent office had adopted a policy saying you can patent gravity, I think we would challenge that policy as violative of both patent law and of the Constitution. And that's sort of what's happened here. The patent office has said you can patent natural phenomena so long as they are, quote, isolated and purified. And we think isolation and purification is insufficient to transform what is a product of nature into a product of people's invention. By isolation and purification, all that they mean and all that the patent office means and all that the patent holder means is that they took the gene out of the body. Taking gold out of a mountain doesn't make it any less gold. It's still a product of nature. Taking a gene out of the body doesn't make it any less a gene. It's still a product of nature, not a product of human beings. And the fact that it was taken out of the body, maybe you could patent the methodology by which you take it out of the body, but you can't patent the thing just because you've moved it into a different place.
Some of the claims in the Myriad patents cover off looking at the genes, determining whether or not there's a mutation, and based on whether or not there's a mutation, determining whether or not the patient is more likely to get breast or ovarian cancer at some stage. Do those tests exist in nature? Do those comparisons exist in nature? Or is that something new that Myriad has come up with?
Well, Myriad hasn't patented the test. What Myriad has done is patented the natural correlation. So that the fact that when you have a particular mutation, you have an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer, that's a function of nature. Myriad didn't cause that relationship to exist. Myriad simply identified the way nature works, the way Myriad would have identified gravity by dropping an apple. They looked at the mutations in the gene, and they said, I see that these correlate historically with a increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. So what they have not patented a test to determine whether or not you have an increased risk. They've patented the fact that when nature gives you a particular mutation, you do have an increased risk. And that's, again, patenting something that nature created, not something that people created.
Are you aware of any activities in Congress or by other public interest groups to try to change the law and the definition of patentable subject matter to cure the problem that you see in the Myriad genetics patents?
The issue of gene patenting has been around for 10 or 15 years now, and there have been efforts both in the courts and in the legislatures all over the world to address this question, and with varying results. In Canada, just for example, Myriad tried to enforce its patents, and the Canadian government simply said, we're just not going to obey your patents, and we're going to keep doing BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing, regardless of your patents. And Myriad blinked. In Europe, there's been litigation over it. In the United States, there has been no litigation until our case, but there have been efforts in Congress. Various legislators have introduced bills that would try to either limit or eliminate gene patents. Those bills have not yet been successful, but when you bring litigation like the lawsuit we've brought, it often has an effect on raising the visibility of issues. And we are working in Congress as well as in the courts to try and eliminate gene patents.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you for inviting me.
My second guest is Warren Wussner, a lawyer and partner with the Schwegman Lundberg Wussner firm in Minneapolis. Warren is an expert in biotechnology patents and is a past chair of the Biotechnology Committee of the American Intellectual Property Law Association. Warren writes a blog on biotech issues at patentsforlife.com. I spoke with Warren from his office in Minneapolis. Good afternoon, Warren.
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling.
The Myriad lawsuit raises a myriad of questions about the patentability of nature-related inventions. And the lawsuit really attacks the patents that are licensed to Myriad under a few different categories. Number one is the isolated versus the non-isolated gene, and describes that as really being a natural phenomenon or a phenomenon of nature. In the LabCorp case against Metabolite, Justice Breyer described the fact that if you're really just making an observation of relationships in nature, that's not really a patentable invention as far as he was concerned. What concerns do you have with Breyer's approach to analyzing patentability of inventions that way?
Well, I think Justice Breyer is confusing the pure statement of a natural relationship, the pure existence of a natural relationship, with a patent claim to a useful diagnostic assay. The claim that Justice Breyer, in a sense, really would means to object to is a claim that says, claim one, human blood that has X milligrams per deciliter of homocysteine and Y milligrams per deciliter of cobalamin. In other words, a high amount of homocysteine and a low amount of cobalamin. And
just to translate that, Warren, in a more pedestrian language, if you had a high level of an amino acid in your blood, it meant that you likely had vitamin B deficiencies. Is that right?
Yes, if you have a high level of the amino acid homocysteine in your blood, the inventors of this assay that had the claims of which claims to which were before the Supreme Court, if you had this high level of amino acid, it indicated that you had a vitamin deficiency. And Justice Breyer leapt from the claim language, which was simple but still described a diagnostic assay, a method of diagnosing a cobalamin deficiency by assaying a sample of blood for homocysteine and correlating the level of homocysteine to the presence or absence of a cobalamin deficiency. That's a gloss on the language of the claim. And he somehow focused or reduced the claim to sort of the core biological relationship, that the fact that, biological fact, that humans have cobalamin in their blood and have homocysteine in their blood, and complex biological factors cause an elevated level of homocysteine to, if not be responsible for cobalamin deficiency, to indicate it. And he reduced the claim, which in fact is carried out by the hand of man, is requires human intervention to take a blood sample, to assay it, probably using a machine of some sort, analyzer of some sort, determining the amount of homocysteine, and then correlating that amount, maybe using a table, to the possibility of a cobalamin deficiency. He took that assay and reduced it to its underlying biological relationship, which all people have, whether or not you have a cobalamin deficiency. You've got a certain amount of homocysteine in your blood. Well, nobody was trying to claim blood containing a certain amount of homocysteine. Nobody was trying to claim a blood containing a certain amount of homocysteine and a certain amount of cobalamin. Nobody was trying to go up to every person and say, your blood contains homocysteine, so pay me a royalty because you infringe my patent claim, mainly because you could never get a claim like that, any more than you could get a claim to water in the ocean containing 1% sodium chloride. I mean, that's a natural phenomenon. It's existed for a long time. It may be useful, I guess, if you want to make salt. However, a claim to a method of evaporating seawater under certain conditions to recover salt might well and probably has been patented in the past. So again, I think that the justice was being overly reductionist and reducing a diagnostic, a useful diagnostic assay. In fact, if it wasn't useful and valuable to doctors, it wouldn't be a subject of litigation, but reducing it to its underlying natural phenomena and then being critical of a patent claim on that phenomena when the claim, in fact, was not on that phenomena at all.
In the Myriad lawsuit, the subject matter is mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, which, as I understand it, if you have those mutations, then you have an increased risk of getting cancer. And I suppose they see the correlation between the subject matter and the Myriad patents and Justice Breyer's comment in the metabolite case to give them encouragement to claim that what is really being claimed here is claiming a natural phenomenon, or at least the observation of a natural phenomenon.
Yes, that's exactly right. But again, reduce the claim to its underlying natural phenomena. Its natural phenomena might be a person having a chromosome, on their chromosome, having a genomic system that contains a gene that has mutations at positions Y and Z. Well, a certain number of women have that gene and have those mutations and have a predisposition to develop, I guess, is it breast cancer? But nobody's going around to women and saying, okay, you know, you have to give me a sample of your blood so I can determine if you have this mutation. If you do, you owe me money. The claim is, again, is to a diagnostic assay. It's based on an underlying condition of the genetic system, of the genome of the patient. But it involves assaying, you know, for these mutations in a particular gene and then drawing the conclusion that this patient may have a predisposition to cancer. And of course, this is of great value, particularly in families that are cancer clusters, where, say, if your mother and your two aunts and your sister all have breast cancer, you want to know if you're going to get it. And these kind of tests can be very valuable to people who are at risk of developing breast cancer. But again, that's what the patent system is designed to do. It's designed to give people a monopoly for a limited period of time on inventions that improve society. And this is an invention that does clearly improve the quality of life, if not life itself, for, you know, significant patients. And again, nobody's trying to claim a human being having a gene having mutations at positions X and Y. One time I was having dinner with friends who were, they're English professors, very educated people. And they said, don't tell me that somebody can patent my genes, you know, the genes in my body. And of course I had to say, well, nobody can patent the genes in your body. But what they are patenting are genes in an isolated condition that have been removed from the body and put into a context where they are bound to DNA, to which they're not normally bound, to where they're not bound to anything, and perhaps are taken apart and analyzed just for these defects, we'll say, or mutations that you describe. So the patent office for many years has permitted claims to isolated natural substances. It didn't just start with genes. I mean, years ago, it was known that diabetics benefited from receiving insulin. Well, insulin is a natural product, and you can actually give, you know, pig insulin to humans, and they react very well to it, to human diabetics. And there was a controversy, isn't this a natural substance? How can we patent, you know, God's handiwork, a product of nature? But the courts became convinced, and so did the entire scientific medical community, that in the isolated state, insulin is different than it is when it's circulating in the blood in small amounts and varying amounts in both people and animals. So isolated natural products became recognized to be patentable subject matter, as we say. You could get a patent not on the insulin as it was circulating through your blood, but on insulin that was isolated and purified to the extent that it was a useful commercial product.
Some of the claims in the myriad patents talk about laboratory techniques used to carry out the tests to identify whether or not the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes are present. And in your blog, you talk about the effect of the Bilski decision as probably, in the first instance, an inappropriate test for determining whether or not a method preempts a natural phenomenon. And I'll ask you about that first. And second, I'll ask you about the specificity of the claim in the myriad patent, talking about a particular test using electrophoresis to and polyacrylamide gels to isolate this stuff. First, let me ask you about Bilski and the test for determining whether or not a method preempts the use of a fundamental principle. Could you just explain why you're not too keen on the Bilski analysis?
Well, I think very few patent attorneys are keen on the Bilski analysis, and it's almost not even an analysis. I see it as sort of a straw man. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has come under a lot of fire when it allowed patents to business methods. And I, at one point, say only semi-jokingly that you might be able to get a claim to a penny saved is a penny earned, because in a sense that's a business method, or a stitch in time saves nine. Those are abstract ideas, but they come also awful close to business advice. But anyway, the Federal Circuit became under increasing criticism because it was allowing claims to methods of arbitrating disputes, methods of trading stock options, and things that people considered to be extremely, you know, abstract. And so for a while, the Federal Circuit was using what was called the useful practical and tangible result, useful concrete and tangible result, to measure the patentability of methods or processes. And again, because it was coming under fire for allowing what the business community, particularly in software and financial management community, saw as increasingly abstract inventions. In Bilski, which was the claims at issue were to managing financial risk and did seem quite abstract, the Federal Circuit regressed, in a sense, back to a decision it could have written in 1930 if the Federal Circuit had existed, but And it said that in order to be patentable, a method had to either be tied to a particular machine or apparatus or transform matter from one state into another. That's a pretty close paraphrase of the wording of their test. Now, this harkens back to the days when processes involved making stainless steel or vulcanizing rubber, polymerizing polytetrafluoroethylene into Teflon. And doesn't really reflect the current situation in technology, where many inventions are carried out by computers or automated, use very sophisticated measuring devices, but don't necessarily correlate, shall we say, to like building a machine or altering, making a new kind of glass or plastic. And so the court, the Federal Circuit, held that the claims in Bilski failed to meet this test. They weren't tied to a particular machine or apparatus, and they didn't transform matter. Well, the problem is that this opens, well, there are many problems, certainly bad problems for business method patents, but the biotech scientific community is becoming extremely alarmed, because you can carry out diagnostic assays without necessarily changing the substance you're measuring. You might just be detecting it. And furthermore, the claims to diagnostic assays are often written without a particular machine being used to carry out the assay. Look at the what I call Metabolite Labs case, where LabCorp case, where the claim was simply written a method of detecting a cobalamin deficiency by assaying bodily fluid for the presence of homocysteine. It didn't say how it was carried out. Now, you know it had to be carried. It was carried out using a machine or reagents or chemical reactions of some sort. And that was sort of the issue in the Myriad claims. They said the same thing. They were measuring, assaying a stretch of DNA for mutations. But the main claims didn't say how that was done. And what they did in the dependent claims, in the narrower claims, is they sort of, the attorneys prosecuting this patent application, built in the machines that would be used to assay the DNA. They said, you know, you could chop up the DNA and run it up a gel, use electrophoresis to look for the mutations. And there are many other ways to do it, or a number of other ways to look for genetic mutations that are tied to certain machines. You can do it by polymerase chain reaction, and there are other ways. But will the courts hold eventually that such assay claims that do list essentially every possible instrument or machine that could be used to diagnose the particular chemical or gene you're trying to detect, will they hold that those are sufficiently particular, or will they say, well, you know, you don't need any certain kind of machine, and thus ignore those limitations? I don't see how they can ignore them given this test. But to back up a little bit, the test is archaic. I think the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit, in imposing this test, expected to be reviewed by the Supreme Court.
I understand that Bilski is headed for the Supreme Court. Is that right?
Yes, the Supreme Court accepted certiorari and is going to hear arguments on Bilski this fall, which means they'll probably issue a decision sometime in the winter or spring. I think this case is ripe to be reversed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, Justice Souter was one of the three justices that was critical of the diagnostic claim in Metabolite Labs. But this isn't a diagnostic claim that's going up before it at this case, and he's going to retire. I think the Supreme Court in the past has had a very expansive view of what's patentable and what isn't. if the hand of man is involved, the Supreme Court historically has affirmed the patentability of methods and process claims and composition of matter claims. Remember, the Supreme Court affirmed that genetically engineered organisms were patentable in the Chakrabarty decision more than 20 years ago. They also more recently affirmed that plants could be patented, the subject of regular utility patents. And that had never been ruled on by the Supreme Court, even though the patent office had been issuing patents on plants for many years. So the Supreme Court has been liberal, we'll say, in its view of what's patentable and what isn't. And I think in imposing a very, what I consider to be very narrow test on the kind of methods or processes that are patentable, the Federal Circuit is inviting the Supreme Court to reverse it and to perhaps go back to the useful, concrete, and tangible result standard that the Federal Circuit applied before Bilski.
Even if the narrower test in Bilski is used in the case of some of the claims of the Myriad patents, that it's tied to a particular machine, one of the claims refers to doing the test on by measuring the electrophoretic mobility of the DNA on a polyacrylamide gel. Is that enough to tie it into a particular machine or apparatus as Bilski requires for the moment?
I would think it would be. That's a key step in the process, is determining, you know, whether or not the mutation is present. If you need an apparatus such as an electrophoretic gel to make that determination and you put that in the claim, that is very similar to saying employing a computer to make a certain calculation. It's actually more concrete. You're actually contacting the physical substance, the DNA, with the gel and then seeing how it behaves when exposed to an electrical current. So I think that, I also think such a test transforms matter. You're breaking the DNA up to see if it has what nucleotides it has at certain positions. So I think that that would meet the Bilski test.
It strikes me that the Myriad lawsuit is really one about policy as much as it is about patentable subject matter. And given that, are you seeing any movement in Congress or by lobbyists to somehow or other amend our patent laws to ban gene patents or biotech patents that are critical to medical care or research?
Well, there has been some policy movements in that direction, but they haven't been congressional. You know, the important ones have not risen to the level of being public laws. An example is National Institutes of Health, NIH, not too long ago, and they have emphasized it since, released guidelines on licensing research tools made with government funding. And that could include isolated genes and transformed organisms and isolated proteins, novel proteins. And this directive mostly applies to, well, it did apply to NIH-funded research, but NIH funds research in a wide variety of universities and nonprofit institutions. And what the guidelines said is, if you patent this technology, that's fine with us, and it's fine with us if you license it, but you must grant non-exclusive licenses. And that's a big step, because you tend to get less money for a non-exclusive license. And what NIH was saying is, we want as wide a dissemination as possible of these early stage research tools that may not have value as drugs themselves, but may lead to the discovery of drugs. So that was certainly a concrete step that NIH took. Now, their regulations don't have the force of law, but in speaking to tech transfer people at nonprofit institutions and universities, you realize that they take these guidelines very seriously and, in fact, do license these research tool patents non-exclusively, and also try to make them available for research purposes through very liberal material exchange agreements. So I think there certainly is a feeling in the scientific community that early stage discoveries in biotechnology, as opposed to things like that are immediately useful as, say, new drugs, anti-cancer drugs, but that early stage research tools should be made widely available. Now, when you get to the point that you've reduced the research tool to an assay that's useful to detect a particular disease to then help guide its treatment, that's where we get on the edge of the LabCorp case and Ariad and some of Prometheus and some of the other cases that are working their way through the system. But I think these are ultimately policy decisions, or maybe driven into the legislature. I think it was in 1996, Congress passed a law that said that surgical procedures could be patented, but the doctors and their employers couldn't be sued for damages for infringing the surgical procedures, except under quite narrow circumstances. So there was a policy decision that people were quite upset by in the patent community when it first came down. But then people realized that it was pretty rare to patent a surgical procedure and try to collect royalties from doctors who might be employing it to help their patients. And whatever furor there was back then died down. And relatively few institutions tried to patent surgical procedures at this point. Occasionally patents on them do work their way through the system. But even if they're granted, they're difficult to enforce. So here's a case where the American Medical Association, among others, felt that patenting surgical procedures would inhibit the dispersal of medical knowledge and teaching hospitals and that kind of thing. And so they lobbied very successfully to essentially eliminate damages due to infringing certain patents on medical procedures. Now, will it go so far as to say, a diagnostic procedure where all you're doing is detecting the levels of a substance in the blood and then drawing a medical conclusion from those levels, will that be altered in some way legislatively so you can't patent it or you can't get royalties on it or you can't charge somebody with infringing your patent even if you get a patent? Will it go that far? I don't know. I certainly hope not. Because again, to come full circle, would our society be better off without assays for genetic predisposition to cancer? Would we be better off for assays without assays to detect prostate cancer? I don't think anybody thinks we would. Now, it could be that Ariad is not doing a very good job of administering of making these assays available to people that need them at a reasonable cost. But now we're getting outside of the area of patent law, and we are entering areas of policy that where the balancing really should be done by Congress and not by, I don't think, by the court or by patent attorneys.
Thank you very much for these insights, Warren.
Well, thank you for your call, and you raised some very interesting questions that will be answered in the fairly near future.
My guests for this podcast have been Chris Hansen, in-house counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union in New York City, and Warren Wussner of the Schwegman Lundberg Wussner firm in Minneapolis. For further information about the Myriad Genetics case, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.